I would also like to thank Holly and for inviting me to this. I'm not sure I fit in to the conference, but that's probably why I learned so much. And I want to begin by, I'm going to be talking from the other end of the telescope here. I work as the ombudsman at NIH, and among my responsibilities is working with scientists who are in conflict, helping to resolve those conflicts. It may be whole teams, it may be pairs, it may be NIH scientists with other scientists. So I'm going to be taking us to the dark side. Before I do that, I want to acknowledge that all of what I'm talking about, all the work that I do in this regard is with my colleague, Michelle Bennett from CCR at NCI, who's back there and some of you have met. Interestingly, I mean, Michelle and I usually present this as a team, but in one of the great, one of those many ironies that the academic world affords us, we were not given permission to perform as a team in the Team Science Conference. We needed one spokesman. This is a problem because ordinarily Michelle presents the verbs and adverbs and I do nouns and adjectives, so I hope you're able to make sense out of what I'm talking about. One of the things, in addition to my work with disputes among scientists, and in the course of doing that work is when I met Michelle, and at the point, she was working towards promoting collaborations and helping to support and develop research teams. We found a lot of overlapping interest. And the more I was immersed in the negativity of failed scientific teams, the more I came to realize that I couldn't have a good understanding of what makes for a successful scientific team only by working with failures. So what one of the things we did is put together a very informal study of five successful scientific teams at NIH. And in that study, we interviewed, we had a colleague, Samantha Levine Finley, a former investigative reporter, and we set her free to interview all of the members of these five teams. So that's another source of input to what I'm going to be talking about. Part of the reason I bring this up is because we've had the opportunity, both in my conflict work and in the research with these teams, we've had the opportunity to learn about the more intimate details of scientific teams, of what goes on a daily basis. And in the course of listening to the incredible presentations that help us understand the preconditions and conditions for successful scientific collaborations, and especially in the course of the network analysis presentations yesterday afternoon, I began to think about what was missing from what I understand as a person who runs an emergency room for failed scientific collaborations. What's missing? And there are two kinds of things that are missing that I think are essential, and I'll get to both of them. But the first one is you may remember the opening of Anna Karenina, where Tolstoy says, "Happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way." Well, he may have been right about family life. I think he was wrong if you apply it to scientific teams. And in fact, I think it's the other way around. Unhappy scientific teams are all alike. There's a certain commonality there. But there is a uniqueness and individuality to successful scientific teams. And I think that is lost in the attempt to identify the shared characteristics of successful teams. When Michelle and I look at the teams that are successful, we see such tremendous variability in team culture, style, methods, and modes of leadership. And I'm concerned that the attempt to identify common characteristics may keep us from understanding some really important things. One of the things that's really important and that has not been mentioned once in the course of this and is so prominent in our work is no one has mentioned the joy associated with participating in a successful and stimulating scientific team or collaboration. the sheer magnetic pleasure of working closely with someone with whom you share the passion of discovery and problem solving. And I think that's not just an indicator of a successful team. I think there is, in some complex adaptive system way, a causal relationship between an atmosphere that creates that kind of joy, which provides a base from which all sorts of obstacles and difficulties can be transcended. And we need to find a way, or if I can be presumptuous, you need to find a way to talk about that. Okay, so I mentioned that I run, and I'm gonna go back to the dark side now, enough positiveness, that's much more than I can take as a New Yorker. Okay, so I mentioned that I run an emergency room, and in the same way that years ago, emergency room physicians became part of the group of people who were advocating for the use of seatbelts, mandatory use of seatbelts in automobiles, paying attention to recurring features of conflicts among scientists, certain themes, certain kinds of issues, certain kinds of problems that recur, that occur over and over again, I became interested in doing some kind of preventative work. And from that interest in doing some kind of preventative work, I became aware of the fact that one of the major problems is that scientists often, at the beginning of their work, fail to be explicit about their expectations regarding what they expect from one another, how they will communicate with one another, how they will work together, how they will make decisions, how differences and conflicts will be handled, what will be areas of autonomy, and what will be areas of interdependence. And so borrowing some from work that was done by some colleagues of mine from the Army Corps of Engineers, don't ask how they became colleagues of mine, where they were developing partnering agreements and partnering trainings for large-scale construction projects in an effort to minimize or bring down the number of lawsuits in construction projects, because it used to be the case that every construction project, large-scale construction project, had money in the overhead section built in for litigation. Until people began mediating these things and saying, the mediator said, they don't have to wind up here. You can mediate in advance, in a sense, and avoid the need for litigation. So we, inspired by that, we developed a template which we call a prenuptial agreement for scientists. And and we call it a prenuptial for a reason, and that's partly because, in my experience, very few, the only people more foolish than people falling in love are people beginning a scientific collaboration. They're even more romantic, okay, about what will happen. So the idea of the collaborative agreement is to address this basic categories, and we actually have a template. You won't be able to read it. In fact, I can't read it. But there's a set of 18 questions. They're available on a website address I'll give you later and on my website address at NIH. It's a generic template of questions to be answered, preferably, I think, in writing at the outset of a scientific collaboration. Okay? So we began to promote the use of this kind of prenuptial. You can tailor a prenuptial to a particular collaboration. Obviously, a generic template is not going to be suited for others. Some areas have to be expanded. Some areas of questioning have to not be expanded. Why is this important? It's important for a couple of reasons, but one of the main reasons, this is another one, in addition to joy, the other thing that Michelle and I have found over and over again as an essential component in successful collaborations and successful teams is that some level of trust exists and can be sustained. But we're not talking about the sort of trust that's grounded in a sense of a close interpersonal bond between two people where you know that the other person has your interest in mind. We're talking about structural arrangements that allow for trust to be developed. That is, people know, and that's where the prenuptials come in. The prenuptial is a way of providing a framework from which trust can be developed, especially if the prenuptial is paired with periodic review of the team, of the collaboration, in which you ask, how is it going? In which you look to see, are you meeting the terms that were set forth in your prenuptial agreement? Okay? So, there's another thing to think about here. Now, this is an important point and not an easy one to accept. This is also going to be unreadable, but here, basically, what I'm talking about here is that collaboration introduces into scientific work dimensions of interpersonal interaction that are ordinarily not considered very important in scientific work. Collaboration requires new social relationships, arrangements, in order to integrate multiple approaches to a problem. Now, here's why this is tricky. Now, first, we have to remember, scientists are very much like people, okay? However, when we speak about scientific teams and collaborations, we're not speaking of aspects of scientific work that are typically of real interest to scientists themselves, okay? That is, there are aspects of group dynamics, interpersonal relationships that often seem vague and even somewhat mushy-headed for scientists. They're hard to define. They're difficult to operationalize. Besides, if these were the sorts of issues biomedical researchers were interested in, they would have gone into counseling or psychology or the ministry. Okay, so what does this mean? One of the things it means is that scientists who are working in teams have to begin to be sensitized to dimensions of interaction that typically they have not been tuned in to, that they may not be especially aware of, and in which they may not feel especially skilled. So in all of the things that are the potential advantages of collaboration, we also have areas of vulnerability. Shared decision-making is the advantage of a collaboration, but it's also a point of vulnerability, as anyone who's ever tried to make a decision with another person knows. So when you introduce coming from different disciplinary perspectives, people have spoken about that several times over the last few days. When you're talking about people approaching things from different, using different methodologies, not to mention different institutional frameworks and different cultural norms, whatever it may be, areas of autonomy and interdependence are always complicated to work out. Shared ownership is always, it's a strength, but it's also potentially problematic. There is also collective responsibility and accountability. How do you develop a sense of collective responsibility and accountability? Again, all these things go back to the point with respect to the prenuptial agreements. Two other things to keep in mind. There is a tendency, this is not peculiar to scientists, but there is a tendency in the scientific conflicts that come to me of people to over-psychologize. That is, they attribute too much to the personal characteristics of their staff and collaborators, and they're not fully conscious of the structural and organizational factors that are affecting the way in which people interact with one another and the way in which the team functions. So it's important to try to develop structures in which we can counter this effort to attribute to understand problems in the lab to psychological problems. That's partly where the need for interpreters that has been talked about repeatedly. Now, two other things to mention. Am I out of time yet? 2 minutes, okay. Just a couple of other things to mention. Two quotes that I like. This is old Max Weber. who's quite old now. But the final line there is, the aristocracy of science is hence an unbrotherly aristocracy. And it's something worth remembering. And then my boy Sigmund, my emotional life has always insisted that I should have an intimate friend and a hated enemy. I have always been able to provide myself afresh with both. And it has not infrequently happened that friend and enemy have come together in a single individual, though not, of course, both at once. He was less creative than I. The reason I bring this up is because we have to keep in mind both the nature of the scientific world and the nature of people, that there is a certain kind of pleasure in conflict, just as there is a certain kind of pleasure in competition. That's a part of the scientific world. Now, I'm not suggesting that fostering conflict is important, but this is the most complicated part of running a scientific team in some ways. On the one hand, conflict can be incredibly divisive, so you have to be able to manage it. On the other hand, science thrives on and is driven by disagreement. So you have to be able to simultaneously develop an environment in which, on the one hand, conflict is managed and contained, and on the other hand, disagreement thrives. Okay? Now, people ask about that kind of thing. Don't look at the area of team science to understand this. If you're interested in understanding about these kinds of things and you want resources, the Public Conversations Project has an amazing website with all sorts of guidance about how to discuss controversial issues, much more controversial than the sorts of things that we get ourselves all worked up about. The other area to look in is an interesting amount of work that's been done in the field of deliberative democracy, in which people are talking about how can you bring together people from totally different ideological values, perspectives, and have them have a substantive exchange with one another rather than the kind of charade of name-calling and hostility hurling that passes for debate in American public discourse these days. So look in those areas. Okay, I've gone on too long. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you.